stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN, the Friday edition of our program. We are here to answer questions from non-Catholics. Those of you who are not Catholic and you've got a question about the faith, well, by golly, this is your show. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can also send us an email if you would prefer to do that. The address for that is ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles, our producer, Matt Gabinski is checking the phones for you. He'll be the first voice that you hear. And Rich Jesse working on social media. So if you are listening to us on YouTube or Facebook, we're streaming on both those platforms right now. You can just put your question in the chat screen, if you would, please. And then Rich will send that to us here in the studio. Again, the phone number, 833-288-EWTN. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how you getting along today?
I am well. How are you?
You know, I'm doing decent. Thank you.
Weekend plans for the Anders family?
Well, I have been signed up for an equine care clinic.
Really?
Yes.
You're a horsey family these days.
Well, yes. So I you notice that the I have been signed up. This was a passive voice thing here. I didn't actively take the signing up. I was assigned to this job, so I will go dutifully do my bit and learn about equine care.
I can relate to you on this.
Yes.
I just acquired a new chainsaw. I'm very excited about it. I was going to work on a tree. I was doing these other things. However, our church is having a work day.
So you were assigned to the work day.
I was volunteered. So I don't know. I guess the trees are going to have to wait.
How about that?
So we got an email today. Actually, it came in yesterday at the end of the day. This is from Jeff in Illinois, who says, Dr. Anders, you are such a gift to EWTN and to the church. You have helped immensely as I have navigated my way over the last few years of a 30-year call to communion. I am now registered and taking part in OCIA this year. I really appreciate Tom and his hosting skills also. I don't know about that, but he says, like you, I am seminary educated and was an ordained Protestant minister. Through many twists and turns, God kept reaching out to me since my early seminary years, especially through our Holy Mother. So my question is this. Having heard you speak many times quite clearly about what lacks in Luther's Sola Scriptura formation, I wonder if you could highlight some of the most glaring errors in Calvin's Reformed theology, and could you elaborate on those briefly? So he says he's up to date on Luther. What about Calvin? Could you elaborate, please? Blessings and thanks, Jeff in Illinois.
Yeah, thanks. Gosh, this off the top of my head, it's hard to I mean, where does one begin? I think I can find a lot of glaring problems, right?
Yeah.
So let me do it this way. Let me tell a little bit about Calvin's biography and how he came to his sort of unique theological vision. So Calvin is a very different character from Luther, very different personality. You know, Luther was a deeply introspective and passionate man who you could see him, you know, sort of dashing off with grand designs. I mean, he's called to the monastery, to the monastic life, because he has this dramatic experience in a thunderstorm, and he says, help me, Saint Anne, and I'll become a monk. And he's sort of hurling himself headlong into the precipice of monastic life and, you know, punishing his body in this fitful attempt to attain salvation. And he's, you know, he's really worked up into a kind of, you know, frenzy of religious fervor and anxiety. And nothing could be farther from Calvin's personality. Calvin is a cool cat, right? Luther was from peasant stock, and Calvin not at all. Calvin was not an aristocrat, but he was the son of a cathedral notary. And, you know, today we don't think that being a notary is that fancy a job, but it was in 16th century France. It was like being a lawyer.
Huh.
And so he ran around with in aristocratic and humanist and highly educated and sophisticated circles. And his father's aspiration for him was that he would become an attorney. And so he actually did go to law school for a while. When his dad died, he felt relieved from that vow and burden. And what he really wanted to do was be a humanist scholar and study Cicero and Seneca.
Oh, okay.
And so his first published work actually was a commentary on Seneca's De Clementia. He actually went to the same university that Ignatius of Loyola went to.
Really?
And they were, you know, not that far apart in class, right? Exactly. Mm. He said that when he was in college, that all of those who were desirous of purer religion came to him to learn, right? And he's still Catholic at the time.
Yeah.
But I never met John Calvin, but I mean, I've met this guy, you know, a person who is sort of keenly assured of their own grasp of things and highly articulate and persuasive, and they know they've got the answer, and they kind of cultivate an aura around them of authority that isn't delegated authority. It's just the authority of their own competence that carries them, and they're keenly aware of that. And that was like Calvin's sense of himself. Luther had this tormented conscience and wondered if he had the grace of God. Calvin gives very little evidence of ever having doubted himself. Right. There's very little evidence that Calvin has ever doubted himself. And he was always sort of supremely confident in his views. And in his day, he regarded the Catholic episcopacy as fairly corrupt. And he was not wrong. It was fairly corrupt.
Yeah.
And I think we've all felt the temptation to sit in the pew and be like, man, I could do a better job than that, you know. And well, Calvin had that in spades, you know.
Okay.
And so he read Luther, he read Zwingli, he read Erasmus, he read the humanists, and he basically said, I could do this better, you know. I could do this better. Mm. And he worked out a kind of idiosyncratic synthesis of Reformed and Lutheran theology. Reformed at that time meant Zwingli, and Reformed and Lutheran theology, you know, drawing on some Catholic elements that really, he thought, aimed at the reformation of society, not just the individual conscience, but he thought he could bring social order and decency to the planet and sort of resolve conflicts through his preaching of the word. And I'll come back to that on the other side of the break, but, you know, you got me on a topic I could talk on for way too long, probably.
I'm kind of picking up on that. Jeff in Illinois, sit tight. We're going to continue this on the other side. We'll also talk with Diane in Florida. Lines available for you at 833-288-EWTN for Call to Communion. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews on this Friday afternoon. We are live for you on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. My personal pro tip, and that is because it is a Friday, we recommend that you call early because the phones tend to jam up a little bit on the early side on Fridays. So we don't want to leave you laying in the dust there. 833-288-EWTN. So before the break, we were talking, reading this question here from Jeff in Illinois, just to recap the last part of it. Having heard you speak many times about what lacks in Luther's sola scriptura formation, could you please highlight some of the glaring errors in Calvin's Reformed theology?
Yeah, so I kind of started to give Calvin's biography before the break, and afterwards, basically, my view on Calvin's Reformation is that Calvin, he really emphasized, much more even than Luther, the sort of quasi-sacramental power of the vernacular preaching of sacred scripture. And his conception was if the scriptures are rightly preached, and rightly preached meant the way Calvin would preach them,
yeah,
right, that social order and conformity and well-being would sort of necessarily follow in its wake. You know, that was the reason Europe was in chaos, was because the Catholic bishops had neglected the right preaching of the word. And he really put himself at the center of that picture. Like, his construal of things was the way it ought to be done. And many people start with predestination in defining Calvin. I think that's wrong. I think he came to his emphasis on predestination through the back door, because what he found was, well, he finally got to put his plan into action. He was able to get up in the pulpit in Geneva and preach the thing the way he wanted to preach it. And he didn't get the results that he thought he would get. Like, he didn't immediately get total conformity and peace and happiness in society. He got a lot of pushback even within Geneva itself, right? And so most of his career in Geneva was spent contending with the anti-Calvin faction in that city. There was a divided town, and the native Genevans kind of resented him. He was a foreigner and a Frenchman, and they called him that wicked Frenchman, and the French Pope, they would call him. And they were like, well, you know, we got rid of one Pope, well, now we got another one. You know, we don't like this Calvin guy. And so he didn't take criticism well at all. And so for him, the predestination thing was one way of explaining why not everybody saw the obvious truth of his righteousness. and he came up with a brilliant explanation. Oh, they're not elect. The elect hear the voice of Jesus and respond, but these reprobates over here don't get the message. And so for him, predestination was as much an ecclesiastical dogma as it was a metaphysical one. It was a way of accounting for the fact of diversity in the body of Christ, and that not everybody was on board with him. And of course, that became the point of Calvinism that people hammer on the most, this doctrine of predestination. But it really did land in the sort of ecclesial context. And so, you know, move forward 500 years in Christian experience, and I grew up in a Calvinist church, a Presbyterian church, and my experience of Christianity as a child really highlighted a lot of Calvinism had dropped away. But one thing we retained was this absolute certainty that we were right and everybody else was wrong, and that the frame of reference for approaching reality really was Calvin's frame of reference, namely, we have the truth and we're sort of beyond criticism. And the thing we can best do for the world is make sure other people think like us. Right? So proselytism was a very important part of the evangelical Calvinism, of which I was a part. And I really think now, in retrospect, that that is a really, really flawed approach to reality, and it's very damaging and devastating to one's own spirituality to take that view of one's neighbor. You know, Christ admonishes us to take the log out of our own eye before we take the splinter out of our neighbor's.
Yeah.
One thing that struck me in studying Calvin for years and years was that, I mean, I read tens of thousands of pages of Calvin. I don't ever remember finding the guy apologize. Like, I'd never encountered him taking responsibility for something and changing his point of view. It was always, any controversy he was in, his opponent was always the most desperately wicked person on the planet and reprobate of God and deserving of death. Like, it was superlative criticism of his opponents, and never turning that light of critical analysis on himself. I mean, he would confess in a kind of general way, oh, I'm a miserable sinner saved by grace. But if you say, okay, give me specifics, you know, like, that's, he didn't do it. He was sort of incapable of self-criticism. He was so confident in his own righteousness. And I think that, to me, is the central flaw of being a Calvinist, right? And it's very different from the disposition of the Catholic, which begins with the presupposition that I cannot know that I have God's grace. I can't presume that I'm righteous, that I'm right, that I'm holy, you know, that I'm close to God. Those things are, I mean, we aim for those, we aspire to that,
sure,
but we can't presume it. I found on becoming Catholic that my moral disposition towards the rest of the world shifted radically and in a positive way. I became a better human being in virtue of becoming Catholic.
Well, there you go. And Jeff in Illinois, thanks so much for your email. If you would like to send us an email for a future show, the address is ctc@ewtn.com. ctc@ewtn.com. We'll get to the phones in just a second. I want to give a shout out to the birthday boy. He is going to be 70 on a Sunday. We're talking here about our very own Pope Francis.
No.
Pope Francis.
No.
Look at me.
Pope Leo.
Well, you know why I said that?
No.
Because his middle name is Robert Francis Prevost.
Well, isn't that inconvenient?
I know. So, as I'm looking at the sheet here, I'm saying, oh, Francis. No. Pope Leo the 14th is going to be 70 on Sunday. We are very blessed to be giving that birthday shout out. As you probably know, he is the 267th Bishop of Rome, the very first Augustinian Pope, and the second Roman Pontiff from the Americas after Pope Francis.
After Pope Francis.
So see how I bring it all around there? Anyway, so happy birthday and congratulations to you, Pope Leo the 14th. All right, if you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Diane in Florida, listening online, EWTN.com. Hey, Diane, what's on your mind today?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And I have two very simple questions for you, Dr. Andrews, but you just triggered a thought while you were talking about Calvin, and I'd just like to add my two cents about that. It seems like every huge social movement that's been created has been created by one person who had a very extreme slant on life from whatever he's got going on personally, and then he finds people to follow him, and people are copycats, and therefore we end up with this divided church. And I just feel that every movement, good or bad, is started with one person with a very, very strong and powerful impact that and he's driven, and then people follow, and then the world comes along. Good or bad. And then the fault is actually just Jesus is not the one, you know, and these other movements. But that's just my take. I appreciate your explaining that about Calvin. I didn't know those things. But my two questions are the difference between justification and salvation, and the difference between dogma and doctrine, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me start with the last one first, if I could. So a dogma is a teaching of the Catholic faith that has been solemnly proclaimed by the magisterium, and not just solemnly proclaimed, but specifically the Church teaches that this proposition, this statement, is true in virtue of having been directly revealed by God. Right, so there are a lot of things that are true that have not been directly revealed by God in the deposit of faith. Right, a dogma is true, and it's true in virtue of having been divinely revealed. Right, and the Church singles it out for notice and says this is something about which all Catholics must agree, all Christians must agree, because it's part of the deposit of faith given by God as such. Right. And a classic example of a dogma would be the dogma of the Trinity or the dogma of transubstantiation. These would be two dogmas of the Catholic faith. A doctrine is just a teaching. It is a teaching of the Catholic Church. It may or may not be a dogma.
Okay.
And sometimes there are doctrines that are manifestly not dogmas, and they are part of the Catholic patrimony, but Catholics are not obligated to believe them. I'll give you an example. It is a doctrine of Molinism, which is a Catholic theological philosophical school, that God grants the grace of salvation to those whom he foreknows by his middle knowledge, those whom he foreknows will make good use of the grace if it's given to them. All right? That's a doctrine of Molinism.
Okay.
There are a lot of Catholic theologians that hold to that doctrine. Then there are the Dominicans, and they say, away with you Molinists. You Molinists, you guys are hardly any better than semi-Pelagians. A curse upon you. Go away. Go away. All right? And no, God does not grant grace based on his foreknowledge of counterfactuals. He grants grace based on some ineffable reason known only to the divine will that's not based on anything external to him.
I'm still working on middle knowledge.
I'll get to that in a minute.
Oh,
right?
Boy.
At whereupon the Jesuit types say, away with you, a pox on your house. Oh, you Dominican types, you're no better than a Manichaean, right? And we had a big fight between religious orders in the 16th century on this question. Does God grant grace based on his knowledge of future counterfactuals? And knowledge by way of future counterfactuals is what we call middle knowledge.
Oh, okay.
And they were fighting it out, and it got hauled up in front of the Pope, in something called the Congregatio de Auxiliis, And they actually wore out two or three popes on this thing. And the last one to hear the case said, okay, look, shut up, go home, teach theology, preach the gospel, quit calling each other heretics. I'll let you know. I'll decide the issue and I'll let you know. That was 500 years ago, and the Pope still hasn't decided the question. So they're two different doctrines. They're incommensurate. You can't hold them both at the same time. Both of them are allowable in the Catholic tradition. Both of them are part of the Catholic theological patrimony. They can't both be true, and both of them are Catholic. And you're allowed to have differing opinions on that question. There are other points of theology that are like that. There's a teaching of the Catholic Church somewhere that's just not a dogma. And that's the difference. That's the distinction. All right. So what does Jesus do for us? What does Jesus do for us? Well, you know, I'd say at the end of the day, but maybe I should say at the end of the eschaton, at the end of the age, what he does is save us from hell, right? And grants us the possibility of life forever with him in heaven. And the word that seems to best capture that is he saves us. He saves us, right? He saves us from ourselves. He saves us from sin. He saves us from death. He saves us from the devil. He saves us from sickness. He saves us. Salvation.
Yeah.
Justification is a way of explaining one aspect of how Christ saves us. It is not the totality of salvation. It's an element of salvation. It describes something that Christ does in the process of saving us. And it specifically refers to the way in which God takes a person who is in sin and therefore at enmity with God,
uh-huh,
and moves them to the position of being a friend of God, moves them to the position of being reconciled to God.
Mm.
Now, that is a part of salvation, but it is conceptually distinct. Let me explain. Imagine this is not the case, but you could perform the thought experiment. Imagine a universe in which you have a sinner who's not reconciled to God, and God corrects that situation, and he reconciles the sinner to himself and says, okay, we're friends now, and when you die, I'm going to annihilate you. Like, that would not be unjust on God's part. I mean,
okay.
God could do that. He could say, okay, we're buddies while you're alive, but when you die, that's it. God could have created a world in which that was the case, in which you could have been justified, but not saved from death.
Oh, okay.
Right? That's not the world he made.
No.
He made one in which justification is necessarily followed by being saved from death. Right? You see what I'm saying?
I do.
So justification is the part of salvation that has to do with how God takes someone who is at enmity with him,
uh-huh,
and turns him into a friend. How is God reconciled to us in spite of our sinfulness? And the Catholic answer to that question is A, he forgives us, and B, he changes our character. He infuses the righteousness of Christ into us, and so the will, which is turned away from God and towards sin, is now turned towards God. And that process, the Church calls justification.
Okay. Is that helpful for you, Diane?
No. How does he change us?
Oh, yeah. Great question. So he changes. This is a mystery. It is a mystery. But the technical language here is grace. That God gives us a share of himself, by the Holy Spirit, he imprints his character onto our hearts so that our personality is changed and that we begin to love God and love neighbor because of what God has done within us. And that interior change, which is worked by the Holy Spirit, and really it's the mechanism of the Catholic life, the faith, the sacraments, the community, the disciplines, all of these things are a part of it, but the ultimate agent is the Holy Spirit, changes our personality, our character, our values, our beliefs, such that we now begin to love God and love neighbor rather than sin.
Diane, thanks so much for your call from Florida. Glad to hear from you on this Friday afternoon. Hey, lines are open for you right now at EWTN's Call to Communion. I can guarantee you can get in if you call right now. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986, excuse me. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. 2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. That email address is always available for you, ctc@ewtn.com. Back in a flash with lots more Call to Communion right here on EWTN. Do stay with us. Call to Communion on this Friday afternoon here on EWTN. We are live on this Friday, and would love to talk with you today at 833-288-EWTN if you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. Hey, if you're listening to us in Ohio, especially mid-Ohio, your EWTN radio station needs to hear from you next week, the wonderful St. Gabriel Radio. The Blowtorch. They'll be airing their fall fundraiser starting this coming Wednesday. So if you're listening in Columbus or Portsmouth or Athens or really anywhere, please support your Catholic radio station. Let's go now to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Fernanda is listening to us in Middletown, New York on the EWTN app. Hello, Fernanda. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question, Dr. Anders. It's about receiving communion. I've been trying to attend Mass, daily Mass, in the morning, and then I work on the weekend, particularly this weekend, I work nights. So the weekend that I work, it's very difficult for me to make it to Sunday Mass because I worked all night, then, you know, I'm very tired. I have to go back the next night. So my question is, if I go to daily Mass tomorrow, which is Saturday, and receive communion during Saturday Mass, and then I go to the evening Mass, which is the Sunday, the vigil for Sunday, am I allowed to receive communion that second time?
Yes, you are. The Code of Canon Law allows communion twice in a day, provided that the second communion takes place in the context of a Mass in which the communicant fully participates.
Okay.
So there, you can receive communion twice in a day, but there are stipulations, and you would be meeting the stipulations.
Okay, Fernanda?
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
You are most welcome. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. Still time for your call, 833-288-3986.
You know, this one was a canon law question.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you know this, Tom, my teeth chatter and my knees knock whenever I get canon law questions because I know I don't know the code, right? I'm not a canon lawyer. And I always tell people, look, I'm not a canon lawyer. I might get this wrong. All you canon lawyer people out there write me and tell me I'm wrong. I got a letter from a canon lawyer telling me I was wrong.
I love it.
Yeah, I was very happy about it because I like to be corrected. I want to get it right. So
sure.
A question had come in the other day about whether intinction was allowable in the Latin Rite of the Church. That's taking the sacred consecrated host and dipping it into the sacred chalice.
Yeah.
And that is not a common practice in the West, and it is the mode of communion in the East. And I was not familiar of any kind of permission for doing that in the West, and somebody had received by intinction, and they thought that was a bit funky, and I thought it was a bit funky. And lo and behold, I got an authoritative email from a pastor, Monsignor, who knows what he's talking about, who said, actually, that's allowable in the Roman Rite. So I went, okay, I stand corrected. So I always appreciate those corrections that come from the canon law types. So thank you very much.
Very cool. Here's a question we received yesterday from Lovak, watching us on YouTube. Couldn't get it in yesterday, so let's do it right now. Lovak says, what is the Catholic definition of spirit? Can a person sense it or cognitively recognize it?
Okay, great. That's a wonderful question. So, spirit can mean more than one thing, first of all. It doesn't just refer to one thing. If we're talking about humanity as a spiritual being, right, like you come, well, I have a spirit or I'm a spiritual person, then we're talking about the immaterial aspect of the human person that has a capacity for God, right? And so I wouldn't know, in that context, I would not know spirit as a focal object. But I would know spirit by participation, perspectivally from the idea that, well, I'm acting and thinking and breathing and loving and willing and reasoning and choosing in virtue of having an immaterial spirit. You follow me?
Yeah.
You know? And so I would have a kind of implicit or kind of inferential knowledge of my spiritual nature in virtue of performing spiritual acts, right, that could only proceed from a spiritual being that has a spiritual capacity. I mean, like, you know, my dog can't make moral choices or aspire to heaven because he doesn't have these qualities, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, although if I threw his rubber ball far enough into the sky, he might aspire to heaven. He's a one issue man. I'll tell you this, dog. The only thing in the world he ever wants to do is chase a rubber ball. That's all he wants to do. And he'll get me up in the morning, late at night, and he'll come and stand at my feet, drop the rubber ball, and look at me and go, right. So, but he's not aspiring to heaven. He's just aspiring one more chase in the backyard.
I love the simplicity of it.
Oh, it's wonderful.
You know, just like, let's get down to the basics of it. Boy, oh boy. By the way, if you're keeping score at home, David gets 5 bonus points for using the word perspectively. Or perspectively.
That was the one.
Yeah. Good grief. Oh, okay, I got to get the dictionary in here along with these other wonderful books. Let's go to Derek now in Indiana, listening on iHeartRadio. Derek, what's on your mind today? Derek in Indiana, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, go right ahead.
Okay, hang on a minute. Okay, why doesn't Jesus ever say he was born in Bethlehem to the Pharisees? Because I'm sure someone should have known and say something, especially to those that knew the Pharisees and Sadducees who believed he was born in Galilee.
Right. I really appreciate the question. So everything we can see about Christ in the Gospels suggests that justifying himself to the Pharisees was not one of his priorities at all, right?
Yeah.
And you know, he answers very few questions, but asks many. Jesus had a very enigmatic way of teaching. I mean, his most characteristic form of teaching was the parable, which he told his disciples he used specifically because he wanted to be obscure, not so that he would be clear, but so that people would actually have a difficult time understanding him.
Mm.
And when he was confronted by the Pharisees, what he generally did was not plead his ancestry or his lineage or his credentials, but his person. You know, he said, "If I cast out demons by the finger of God, that's all the evidence that you need to know that the kingdom of God has come among you," right?
Yeah.
And when Caiaphas the high priest ordered that he be struck before the Sanhedrin, Christ's response was, "Did I speak untruthfully? If something I said was false, then why did you strike me? I mean, if tell me what was false. If something I said was false, tell me what was false. Otherwise, you give an account for why you had me struck." You know, it was always, that was his way, you know, not to justify himself, but just to subsume himself under the divine mission of proclaiming the kingdom of God, healing the sick, raising the dead, giving sight to the blind, and calling Judea to repentance in view of the coming kingdom of God. And he let other people worry about the problem of constructing Christian apologies. That was not his business.
Okay. Appreciate that. Derek, thank you so much for your call today from Indiana. If you're listening to us in the Mobile area, as you know, you're getting a brand new shepherd. The Reverend Mark S. Rivetuso is going to be installed as the 3rd Archbishop of Mobile, Alabama. We've got it for you on EWTN Radio Extra. That'll be this afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Television and EWTN Radio Extra. Here's an email now from Jackie, who says, "Dr. Anders, thank you so much for your helpful insights. I admire your program. Listen as often as possible. Could Dr. Anders please comment on Luke 10, verses 38 through 42, when Jesus visits Martha and Mary? Seems as though Martha is feeling exasperated as she is busy with tasks, meal preparation, housework, etc., and her sister Mary is not helping her. How are we to best understand what Jesus means when he says Mary has chosen what is better and tells Martha, stop worrying? He does not advise Mary to help her sister. We want to worship like Mary, yet we must work like Martha. Thanks, and keep up your great show, Jackie."
Well, you're in luck here, because
Yay.
This is one of the passages of the Gospels that sacred tradition speaks about univocally, meaning there is one take on this in Catholic tradition, and that is that Mary and Martha are types, and they are types for two very good modes of religious life, but one is better than the other. The first mode is the active mode, and that's the one represented by Martha. And I think that's pretty self-explanatory what the active mode is. Mary represents the contemplative mode. And the church says that the contemplative is the better of the two. And in fact, if you don't have the contemplative dimension, the active thing is going to break down on you, right? And St. Paul says the same thing when he says, look, if I give all I possess to the poor and surrender my body to the flames and have, you know, the gift of prophecy and words of knowledge and all of the, and faith that can move mountains and all this, but I don't have love, I'm nothing. I'm nothing. That's a pretty big statement there. I'm nothing, right? Dom Chotard wrote a famous book called The Soul of the Apostolate, in which he talks about the life of the priest and all the active work that a priest has to do. He has to say Mass. He has to hear confessions. He has to marry and bury people and baptize people, and he has to counsel people, and he has to preach the gospel, and he has to take care of the poor, and he's got to keep the roof on the parish, and he's got to do all these things. But if he doesn't have an interior life, all that's going to be for naught. All that's going to be for naught, you know. And the contemplative life ultimately is focused on how do I put myself in the presence of God in such a way that the truths of the gospel aren't just abstract propositions outside of me, but they become the lived realities of my experience, right? That they, you know, that I'm not just talking about the Trinity, I'm indwelt by the Trinity. You know, I'm not just thinking about the atonement of Christ, I am, in fact, appropriating the grace to renovate my interior life. You know, this is the heart and soul of the contemplative life. And it comes through, doing what Martha does, which is to hang on the words of Christ and draw them into one's soul until they become this transformative principle that changes everything. And that's why Mary chooses the better way. But the church says, like you, Martha's way is not a bad way.
Yeah.
It's a good way.
It
right?
is.
But between the two ways, you got to have the merry way.
Sure. All right. And there you go. Thank you so much for that email. It is called a communion here on EWTN. We got this one from Julio, who says, I have a younger Christian friend who has embraced universalism/hell is not eternal. His comments and resources. How can I respond to this heresy? Thanks in advance. God bless.
So I personally, I'm going to give you kind of a off-the-wall answer here, but I think that you have to be upfront and acknowledge that the doctrine of hell, the dogma of hell, is a mystery. And I have, over the years, run into Christian and Catholic apologists who try to rationalize hell and show you why it makes sense. Personally, I've never been persuaded by those arguments. I understand that hell is a dogma of the church, and I'm obligated as a Catholic to believe in it, and it's in divine revelation. That doesn't mean I understand it. And the thing about hell that's so mysterious is that the punishment seems disproportionate to the crime. And the way most apologists handle it is they try to come up with an argument to why that's not the case, to why it really is a proportionate punishment. But again, I think it takes an awful lot of moral imagination to overcome our intuitive revulsion at that idea, right? And it quite honestly, it is an idea that terrifies us and revolts us, and we don't see how it could possibly be reconcilable with the grace and the goodness of God. I think facing the reality of the paradoxical nature of hell in the face and not making false apologies for it is absolutely critical to dealing with it. And all dogmas of the faith, they're not just given to us as abstract truths to work into a theological system. They're meant to be transformative of our personality. We're supposed to interiorize them in some way. And so what I like to do with the doctrine of hell is to look the doctrine of hell square in the face and say, okay, I may not understand it, but this is a description to me of what my life is like apart from God. It's hell now and hell later.
Yeah.
Right? You know, Father Emmerich once said that religious people, I'm going to mangle the quote. I've forgotten it. I'm not going to come up with it. I'll come at it another time.
All right.
Basically, the idea was that, he said religion is for people who want to avoid hell, and spirituality is for people who have already been there. That was the quote. I had to think about it for a minute.
That's a good one.
And it captures the truth of the Catholic faith, right? Which is that you know, the dogma of hell tells us something about the nature of reality, not just about the nature of the afterlife, namely that alienation from God and from all that's good, true, and beautiful, it puts us into the position of a living hell right now, right? And if you can just extrapolate that into the future and think, well, you know, if I, C.S. Lewis said at the end of time, there'll be two kinds of people in the world. Those that say to God, thy will be done, and those to whom God says, thy will be done, right? And we want to be in the former, not the latter. So for me, the dogma of hell is a reminder, constant reminder, to take my own existential plight seriously and try not to be like those people who are living in hell right now, right? And to recognize the great seriousness of the question, right? You know, life is not a joke. Life is not a game. Life is serious, and my moral choices have consequences, and they're real, and they count, right? And I don't get a free pass or get out of jail free card or anything like that. I've got to make my peace with God now, every day, if I want to not live in hell today or tomorrow or for eternity.
Julio, thanks so much for your email. Let's go back to the phones and talk with Dean, a first-time caller from Pittsburgh, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Hello, Dean. What's on your mind today?
Probably the same topic that Dr. Andrews is talking right now. I just, the human beings struggle with sin, whether it's habitual sin or just sin in general, and that you really don't want to go to hell, but you know you're trying to figure out, hey, you know, I mean, you're close to being close to God, and literally just being in apologetic mode all the time, and just asking for forgiveness, because But my thoughts is like, okay. People tell you that, you know, Christ has already paid the punishment for that, but I'm not convinced that's just the only thing that's going to make me a better Catholic, but a better person. But I just want to have that relationship with God that says, you know, that I'm always sorry and forgive me. But in the end, is that your punishment to still be left up to God in the end, no matter what?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So I want to answer that, but I also want to answer a related question that you didn't ask, which is how do you get out of this mode of always just beating up on yourself and going over and over again to confession and saying, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. Personally, and I know that way of life, I've lived that way of life, I don't find that incessant self-condemnation, guilt-ridden, tortured conscience, you know, flagellating myself kind of thing very helpful. And I've discovered over a lifetime that it doesn't really help me not sin, right? It's really good at getting me to hate myself.
Yeah.
But self-loathing is not a real good motive for virtue, right? And that the Catholic tradition actually teaches, and this is where I think most people fall down. It's where I fall down. I know that, but I think it's where most people fall down, that when we have a habitual fault or a habit we want to get rid of, and we just keep falling into the same thing over and over again, that we think the way out of the problem is by making an act of will. Right, I'll just will myself out of this problem, you know. I'm just not gonna do that again. I'm just gonna make up my mind that I'm not gonna do it, and I'm just not gonna do it. And then lo and behold, we do it.
Yeah.
All right. And what the psychologists tell us is that willpower is a vanishing resource. Like it works, you can do it for a little while, but then it eventually kind of fades away. Particularly when you're tired and stressed, and you're working out of habitual patterns, you're not really thinking. You're kind of, you know, you're off in rumination mode, and then the next thing you realize, you're like, darn it, I did it again. I wasn't even thinking, right? That happens to everybody, right?
Sure.
And so that's not the way out of the problem. You're not going to willpower your way out of the problem. And actually, we had a whole church dogma about this, about the nature of grace and free will. And St. Augustine taught it to us. And he said, look, without the grace, we're powerless to morally bootstrap ourselves out of these problems, right? And the way to get out of it is I have to, and this is what the whole monastic life was about. It was about how can I completely rearrange my life, the circumstances, my associations, my thoughts, such that I make it increasingly difficult for me to sin. Like I tackle the problem of habitual sin not head on with willpower, but by constructing a completely different mode of life where the occasions of sin don't occur, or they don't occur nearly as frequently. Hmm. And I put disciplines into my life that will force me into the production of new habits of mind, right? That's the way to do it. You have to construct a rule of life. So, you know, let's say that your habitual sin is drinking, right? And you know the people, places, and things that prompt you to drink. Well, you know, the AA folks will tell you the way to get over that is stay away from those people, places, and things. Start cultivating new people, places, and things.
Yeah.
Right? You effectively do that throughout your life. You put systems into your life that cultivate the formation of new habit patterns. The old trigger arises, but you have a new subroutine that you run in response to the trigger because you've made the plan ahead of time of what you're going to do, right? You have to get proactive like that to tackle these things. You can't just sit around hating yourself, right? And the disciplines of Catholic life are critical. So, you know, I'm not saying you have to do this one discipline, but for many people, say, taking up a devotion or maybe the habit of daily mass or, you know, whatever it might be, they find that aspect of the Catholic faith that can become for them like the substitute for their destructive behavior. I knew a woman who overcame addiction by just sitting in a Catholic church all day.
Wow.
And just staring at a crucifix. I mean, like if you're stuck in a pew staring at a crucifix, you know, you're not off doing that other thing.
That's right.
You know, and that was her way. I mean, there's different things you could do in Catholicism, but you find that part of the tradition that you can lay hold of that will help you create that new habit pattern. Now, in answer to your question, you know, what about God's grace and forgiveness and penance and sin and consequences and all that? Well, you remember, there is forgiveness. There is the mercy of God,
yes.
Right? And when we go to confession, we receive absolution, like, we're forgiven. You're really genuinely forgiven. You can put that sucker behind you and move on.
Yeah. Is that helpful for you, Dean?
Yeah, absolutely. I just think that maybe my struggle is that to understand that even, I know we put it behind us after confession, but in a lighter life than that, I just understand that God can still choose. You're still going to have to pay some sort of punishment, or maybe for the sins that you've committed over in your life, or is it just completely wiped out after your grace?
So let's go back to the analogy of the drug addict, okay? You know, if somebody has ravaged their body through drug use, and then they get clean, and everybody around them forgives them, and they're reconciled to their loved ones, do they no longer carry in their body any effects of their bad behavior? No, of course. I mean, they've wrecked their health, and they may never get it back all the way.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, there are residual effects to bad moral choices that we have to live with. And some of that pertains in the spiritual life, not the ultimate punishment for sin, which is hell, that we can get out of that. But, you know, we do have the temporal consequences of sin, which can be these sort of physical elements that we can, or relational problems we bring on ourselves, but it could also be purgatory, you know, in the next life. But what do you do about that? I mean, do you despair about it? No, you go, okay, so I'm starting from today. Today is where I'm starting from. Let's make the most of where I am from today forward. Now, take a hope from the example of St. Dismas. He didn't get started on this process until like the last 5 minutes of his life. And what did Jesus say to St. Dismas? Today you will be with me in paradise.
Good news there. Dean, thanks so much for your call from Pittsburgh. Good to hear from you, my friend. Here's a question now from Bruce in Kansas. I like to listen to your show on Audible. Here's my question. If Christian ethics dictate that one may not do evil in order that good may result, that is, the ends don't justify the means, then why are Catholics supposed to accept that God has evil in the world so that some greater good may come of it? That seems to be contradictory.
Yeah, thanks. So I'm going to give you the technical answer to the question, and I don't expect it to satisfy you. Okay?
All right.
God's not the agent of the evil. That's the distinction, right?
Mm.
So if you want to put it in human terms, the church says you can never do evil. It doesn't say you can never tolerate evil.
Uh-huh.
Right? Like, I don't have an obligation to go out and actively stop everything evil in the world. And there might be occasions when there are evils that I could potentially stop, and I have a proportionate and prudential reason not to. All right? Refraining from stopping another agent's evil is not the same thing as actively perpetrating evil myself.
Okay. Very good. And one last one here from Eugene in Houston, who says, there are some typos in here. It's as efficacious to see exposition of the Holy Eucharist on TV as it is in real life. If not, then why does EWTN show it on TV? Did you get that?
Yeah, I got it. So basically, does it make a difference if I go to Eucharistic Adoration in person versus watching it online? And if it does make a difference, then why would EWTN bother to put the Eucharist online if it's better to be visited in person? All right. So the Eucharistic adoration is not, it's not like some sort of supernatural candy machine where you put in your time, you pull the lever, and you get out the same quantity of grace every time you go in. It's not mechanical like that. And with any devotion, the benefit you derive is proportionate to the charity with which you bring it, or you bring to it. And so some soul might go to Eucharistic adoration in the chapel and receive nothing, and another soul might just think about the Eucharist and be sanctified, right? But because in-person adoration exposes more of your senses, it has a greater capacity or possibility to capture your moral and spiritual imagination and affect your will and your passions. But of course, that's up to you to make that happen. And if you can't get to the Blessed Sacrament, but you can watch it on EWTN, well then watch it on EWTN.
Yeah, go for it. Eugene, thanks so much. Dr. David Andrews, have a great weekend.
Thank you, Tom.
Coming up next, a fresh mailbag of Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan on most of these EWTN stations. Till next week, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Andrews. Have a great weekend.